Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm speaking to Sarah Griesley, a distinguished technology leader with over 40 years in the industry. We talk about what it really takes to be a CTO in a complex enterprise. We talk about leading large-scale transformations, navigating impossible complexity, and how to balance technical debt, business strategy, and leadership at an enterprise level. Sarah shares powerful insights on diversity in tech, building future leaders, and the unexpected lessons that shaped her career, including a moment where she came back from maternity leave to find her entire expertise had become obsolete. If you're a CTO or tech leader looking for real-world strategies, this episode is one you won't want to miss. I'm Adam Horner, your host and a CTO coach dedicated to helping tech leaders thrive. From startup founders to enterprise executives, I work with CTOs to stop firefighting and start leading, building the skills and confidence they need to make a real impact at the highest levels of their organizations. Through tailored, hands-on coaching, I help CTOs shift from being reactive to proactive, enabling them to lead with clarity, delegate with confidence, and position themselves as key strategic voices in their organizations. This podcast is my way of sharing essential leadership playbooks for CTOs who want to grow. Together with my guests, we get into the realities of tech executives, the leadership, offering practical strategies, expert insights, and real-world lessons to help you succeed in your role. Sarah, what a privilege to have you on the show. It's really good to have you here. But to just give our audience a bit of a scene to understand, you know, who you are, where you come from. I mean, I'm happy to say that you are one of the few IBM distinguished engineers that are female. But it'd be really good if you give us a bit of a flavor of your background and how you came to be a CTO with such an amazing title.
Cool. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. So my name is Sarah Griesley. I've been working in technology for more than 40 years now.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's horrendous, isn't it? When I think about it. When I tell you, when I started, we still had punch cards, we had tapes, we had robot machines that used to move the tapes around. You know, it was, and clearly it was the start of the PC, right? If I think there's one thing I think about when I think about my career, I've always ridden the waves of technology, right? Starting with PCs and distributed systems, and then into, you know, the internet, those kind of giddy days of the dot-com bubble, and then into, you know, and on from there. So I did maths at university, and I joined IBM in 1984. And I started as a specialist. I very quickly became a specialist in that technology. And then I took a technical path in IBM. And I think I was very lucky because IBM has this ability for people to have a purely technical path with very little management responsibility. And that allowed me to grow my skills over time to become what we call T-shaped, you know, deep technical skills. But actually, as I got more senior, I grew my understanding of things like architecture, non-functional requirements, engineering, testing, technical debt, all these things that we talk about today and have endured through the last 40 years. So I became an IBM Distinguished Engineer in 2011. And partly that was because of my expertise in building and designing very large, complex systems, really systems of systems. As technology has become more and more complex, right, the ability to actually be able to think about large numbers of systems, how they interrelate, even how you can implement them in a way that minimizes risk, right? So risk, systems of systems, all these things become really important the more complex you become.
And as scales go up.
As your supply chain gets longer and longer as well.
Yeah.
So I was at IBM for many years. And then I sometimes say I had a rush of blood to the head, but I didn't. I got really excited. I got really excited by the thought of going and working at Direct Line. So Direct Line is an insurance group in the UK. It had huge challenges from a technology point of view. It was, you know, driving new ways of interacting with customers. It was looking to address systems that are 30 or 40 years old. And at the same time, it was under pressure in terms of, you know, the insurance market, consumer insurance market is very competitive. So I was enthused by the people that I was going to be working with. So I went to join Direct Line. I felt really fortunate. The CIO at Direct Line was also female. fantastic. You know, she was brilliant, really a really strong role model. But actually, it was a really brilliant team. And we had lots of, you know, it's a problem solving type. You know, at that point, it's all about problem solving. It's all about building the next generation solutions. It was about how do we help this organization, which is risk averse, to move into cloud, to think about data, to think about analytics, think about digital, you know, real challenge. So that was really good, really interesting. And then I think as you become older, then purpose starts to become more important.
Like, yeah.
Certainly for me, purpose became more important. And one of the things that I'm passionate about is not just growing the diversity.
No worries.
We can cut that out, can't we?
Yeah, we can. No problem.
Excellent. Right. So after your time at Direct Line, your purpose becomes more important to you. And I felt there were two things that I was really interested in. One was driving diversity in our technology industry. And the second is about growing the capability of our technical professions, whether it's architecture or whether it's engineering. Because we are moving into a world where technology is becoming more complex, our ability to let things fail is becoming less and less because technology is becoming more and more important, whether it's in-house or in air traffic control or whatever technology. We are getting to a point where we don't want technology to fail at all. But at the same time, we're under huge pressure to deliver more and more quickly. We need to grow capability in the industry to do that. And better to do that somewhere like AWS, where you are working with some amazing, really smart people who are really passionate about the technology and how the technology can help.
And it affects millions.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. And so from AWS, I mean, you've led teams of over 1,000, over 1,300, I think it was. Yeah. There. I've driven some really, really big transformation projects. I mean, not within AWS, but within some of the clients of AWS, as I understand it. But were there any moments where everything just felt, I don't know, impossibly complex, where you thought this is just not going to work?
I would tell you the times where I think things were most complex were usually where you are trying to manage that dichotomy that says this is the best thing to do for the program versus this is the best thing to do for an enterprise. So it's that, you know, partly short-term versus long-term. It's immediate concerns versus longer concerns. It's program budgets versus enterprise budgets. There are a number of times when you think, yeah, oh my gosh, yes. But I have learned, you know, that actually, and this is, for me, this is one of the real skills of a CTO, is actually about, it's about, you know, bridging points of view. It's about bridging different perspectives and different languages and getting people to talk together. And, you know, the way that you resolve these things is always by getting people in a room to understand, right, what the challenges are. There's a really good technique that I was taught a few years ago, which is kind of, it's a bit like a zip. Right. It's very often when you have two sets of people with opposing opinions or opposing points of view, right? It's the differences that people really, you know, batter, right? But think about, if you start by thinking about, you know, the things that you both agree on, right, that builds a different consensus. It's a different way of doing it. And you start from a point of view that says there's a lot that we agree on rather than a lot that we disagree on. Right. And I've always felt that, I think that helps to make it easier.
Definitely. And I think that you often realize that there's actually more that brings you together than there are the differences. The differences are normally relatively small in the grand scheme of things. It's just, they seem like the biggest thing because you're focused in on that little bit.
Yes, absolutely.
And but
I'd say it doesn't mean you always get to consensus, of course.
But it's a good place to start from, trying to zip it together. I like that as a visual metaphor for it. I mean, talk about people, bringing people together. I mean, you and I first met back in December, I think it was, through CTO Academy. And I know you're speaking again shortly, which is great for them. But something that stood out was your approach to leadership in large-scale organizations. How do you ensure alignment across such many different people? I mean, you talked about sort of zipping things together, but, you know, you're leading consortiums of thousands of consultants, and alignment's a hard bit.
Yes. Yes. Hard. I think, for me, there are a number of things that I've learned. One is build a framework, right? Build a framework for having the discussions. Make sure that people are always focused on what the endpoint we need is, right? So it's very easy people are always good at sort of going, here's my position and thinking, but actually, where do we want to get to at the end? And architecture is a bit like that. It's not about the first, you know, you don't do the first step. It's actually about where do I want to get to? And then how are we going to get there? Because that helps to shape the actions and that helps to shape the way forward, in my view. I've learned over time two things. One is to understand the culture that you're going into. I think when you're working with customers and you're coming in, understanding culture is really important. And I'm a great fan of radical candor, right? Which is a technique, again, that I've learned over time. And having that emotional intelligence so that you can really get to grips with not just what people are saying, but actually what people mean, because those two are often quite different things.
Sort of the subtext underneath what they're saying.
Yeah. And I think as technologists, particularly when you start out, you don't see that, right? Just being conscious of it helps you to work out. You can be right, but that doesn't mean you're going to win the room. It doesn't mean that you're going to get everyone to follow you. So it is not just about having the answer. It's actually about how you bring people with you.
Absolutely. That's one of those things I end up coaching quite a lot, is that difference between winning the argument, because we're logical creatures, engineers, at the end. A plus B equals C. Everybody can see that, right?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And that's the bit when you begin to really get to the idea of actually when somebody means C, they mean something different.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of the fundamental difference, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. And I think, you know, language is really important, right? Things mean different things in different organizations or different industries. I remember working with people from Deloitte many years ago, and I thought we were talking about the same thing, but we were not talking about the same thing at all. It was the same word, but we were using it in different ways. Being clear about language is also really important and shows some of the challenges you get with AI, but that's a whole different discussion.
It is, isn't it? I've had something very similar to that, actually. I was working with a consultancy and we were talking about one of these three-letter acronyms. I can't remember which one it was, but it was one of these three-letter acronyms that is used quite generically. And actually, in this case, the two completely different acronyms had very different usages, just the same letters across two very different domains. Yeah. And there's a conversation going on, which at the time, it's almost like a comedy sketch made up perfectly. Each side was talking about this thing in a rather generic and high-level way. And then at some point, somebody said, "And yeah, and so that's it for the turnstiles then." But everybody on the other side of the table went, What? They've used it, and then that sort of reset. Yes. Okay, let's do this conversation again, because they've just been talking about different things.
Yeah, yes. And you think, you know, yes, absolutely. So I'm, you know, a great proponent of, let's be very clear, working in an insurance company, you talk about risk all the time, right? But they have, again, different meanings for risk. So they talk about risk as a financial term, right? Versus, you know, they talk about elements of the budget as risks and opportunities. And it took me ages to work that one out. But, you know, just different types of risks. Everything has a risk profile and everything has a risk associated with it and attached to it. And so, yes.
And yet when you work in insurance, sometimes it has a price tag attached to it because it's part of the product.
Yes, there's always a price tag.
Should we step back a little bit in time then and sort of have a look at some of the early learning? So when you first stepped into the executive role, what was, you know, in terms of that change, that transition, what for you was the hardest part of the transition?
So I think for me, the hardest part of the transition was moving from no to not knowing all the answers. Because you suddenly realize, if I have to know all the answers, A, I can't scale. B, I'm just going to dive too deep. So first of all, you think, I have to think more broadly. So I have to think about things that I wouldn't have otherwise thought about. And by the same token, I have to accept that I don't know all the answers. Right. And I came from being the country specialist in a particular technology to actually being someone who was focused on architecture and design, which is very much about, you know, what the thing that was really important was the process and asking the questions and the curiosity and the thinking, rather than having the answers or knowing the answer. And that was really interesting, particularly for technologists, because every technologist really wants to dive deep into, does it work? How does this happen? What is the answer to this? So it was about not knowing, it was also about knowing the questions to ask. Right. Because again, the questions are not just technical questions. The questions are also around budgets, around payback, around, you know, designing not just business functionality, but to think about, you know, the non-functionals, manageability, availability, all these things that actually make are really important.
And were you aware of that at the time, or was that something you sort of realized looking backward, that was actually where my gap was between this knowledge and curiosity?
So it was very obvious, and I'll tell you why it was really obvious, because the technology that I was a country specialist in, I went on maternity leave. And while I was on maternity leave, they discontinued the technology.
Right? Wow. Okay. So significant abrupt shift.
Yeah. So that was I literally had to take a step back and go, wow. You know, so I've suddenly moved from being really important because I really understand this technology to I don't understand any technology because it's all changed. I mean, luckily, it was kind of the start of the internet. So it was mid-90s. So from that point of view, it was great because I could leap on the bandwagon of the next technology. And
riding the wave, as you said.
Yes, riding the wave. But by the same token, it did make me really focus on, and I do tell people to do this, focus on your value to the organization, right? Because I think if you understand that, that helps you in terms of your next job, but it also helps you to have confidence. And that value isn't always because you know most about this subject. It may be because you are asking the questions. It may be because you understand what this means from a customer point of view. There are many reasons why your contributions have value and they're not all technical.
In fact, very few of them are technical in the grand scheme of things when you get there, in my experience, certainly anyway.
Yes, indeed.
And I mean, that sort of begs the next question, because I mean, clearly you had a very big personal transformation and rather abrupt and fast going off on maternity leave and coming back to a different world almost. But in terms of leading high stakes transformational projects within organizations, you know, when you are modernizing that technology, for example, you did this at Direct Line Group, they often have a sort of, in my experience, a bit of a breaking point, a moment where things just feel as though they're going to go past the tipping point and not come back again. You're nodding. I mean, you got a good story for one of these.
Yes. Gosh. Oh, there were a number of points where I thought we were breaking everything, I have to say. Yeah. I think some of it was the move to cloud, right? And that was a skills and expertise discussion, because actually, you know, we were moving to cloud not because we wanted to do the same things that we're doing on premise and just lift and shift them. Actually, we wanted to drive to do things that we would not otherwise be able to do, right? And did not want to recreate our whole Oracle estate on cloud, right? So it was literally we are not doing this, right? Stop. Let's go back. Literally, we cannot do this anymore.
Throw it down to first principles, go back to the drawing board and build it up in a completely different way.
Yeah, and that was quite challenging because there were project timeframes, skill gaps, etc. But you go, actually, if I do this, I'm building something that is going to last, I don't know, 2-3 years. I need something that is going to be the base for the next 5 to 10 years, right? And that was really the conversation. I will tell you that every project goes through a, oh my God, are we broken stage, when you get to testing, right? And I think that was one of the good things about cloud, right? So we could build a full end-to-end testing environment and we could go, oh, there's a bottleneck here. These machines are not big enough. We need to increase the CPU, et cetera, et cetera. We can rebuild, right? So our ability to get that performance and capacity right, so much easier in cloud.
Because again, you can de-risk it on the fly.
You can de-risk it on the fly.
Because you know which risk you're talking about.
And it's really interesting, you know, because it wasn't something that I thought about at the time as being a benefit of cloud, but actually it really was a benefit of cloud. It was just, you know, particularly in insurance where price comparison websites are really important and the ability to get your data, your quotes back very fast on price comparison websites, right? Then, you know, being able to do that performance testing, it's absolutely critical. And to be able to tune it on the fly was absolutely critical.
And so, what I know of insurance, you've also got the added bonus that you're often dealing with a mainframe database somewhere underneath the stack that is, you know, 40, 50 years old yes. and has been maintained by a couple of really specialist people who have held onto technology all that time.
Well, that was the whole point. We were moving away from that.
Well, that's what you had that as sort of the spec system to move away from.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, huge job. I mean, I did a 2-year technology migration at a startup where, I mean, the key challenge was ensuring that customers weren't affected. I mean, have you ever had a situation we've had to sort of balance business continuity while making some significant changes?
Oh, gosh. I could take you back to working on ATMs in the 80s. And we had a problem that the logs were cleared at 6:30 every morning.
And so for those people who are not familiar with ATMs, that's the cash machine, right, where you get the cash out of the wall.
Yes. And so literally we had to get in at like 5:30 so we could take the dumps of the memory and so that we could work out what was going on before wow. everything was reset at 6 the next morning. Yeah, and things like that are kind of scars on your back that remind you every time you do a system or something that you need to think about the customer, you need to think about these what-ifs. What happens if it goes wrong? What happens if this, you know, if it doesn't, you know, you've got customers saying, I'm not getting my money. How can you minimize disruption to customers, but at the same time, make sure that you're fixing the problem?
Yeah, and talking about fixing things, there's often an element of balance, isn't there? So one of the biggest struggles I find for CTOs is balancing technology, and then, as you said, the business aspect, and then leadership. If you could name, I don't know, if you could name 3 skills that every CTO in a complex organization should master, not just be good at, but master.
I think the first one is build your network, or networking, collaboration, you know, that building relationships, right?
The people you know.
The people you know. Build the relationships. Understand the culture, because as I say, culture can be, particularly in large complex organizations, really critical to your ability to survive or thrive.
Hey everyone, quick question for you. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for my business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is record. They handle everything else. Editing, publishing, and making sure it's optimized perfectly for every platform. They're usually fully booked, but right now, I have a few spots open for new clients. As listeners of this show, you get 10% off launching your own podcast or optimizing your current one. All you need to do is follow the link in the description to book a free one-to-one podcast planning session with Podigy.
What else would I say is really important as a CTO? I think your team is really important, right? Help them to become leaders.
Right, so building the next generation of leaders effectively.
Building the next generation of leaders, I think that's really important as well. It's a hard job sometimes if you're an architect or an engineer and you've got business people going, but I need this, right? So helping them to build leadership skills, you know, emotional intelligence, the ability to relate to the business, all those are really important things as well.
I think
the other thing I was going to say is knowing when to pick your battles, right? There are some things that you have to dig your heels in and go, no, we are just not going to do that, versus ones where you go, am I going to, you know, let's find something that we can both live with.
So when to compromise and when to draw the line and hold it.
Yeah.
It's a good bonus one. I like that. And yeah, because I think when it comes to putting big changes in place, there's often this decision of, well, you know, do I go for holding on to the technology or, you know, getting rid of technical debt, scaling or something, especially when you're at the enterprise scale where small changes have a huge impact just because of the sheer numbers of it.
Yeah, that's technical debt is a really interesting discussion. I always say, the first thing I say, if you are going to crack a system open, right, to do something, then one of the questions you ask is, what else could I do at the same time? Because opening up a system, changing a system has a cost. Even if you change one line of code, it has a cost because it's the wraparound, it's the testing, it's the migration, et cetera, right? And too many times, I think, particularly when you'll get into a problem with technical debt and it becomes really hard to make change, right?
Yeah.
And when you're in that situation, you do get very twitchy about making any change. But I think you have to say, okay, I'm going to do this on system A. What else should I be doing at the same time that we can bundle together rather than make, you know, necessary lots? So it's kind of balancing the amount of change, the risk of the amount of change you're doing versus the cost to make that change, if that makes sense.
Right. So you're sort of spreading out the cost of making that change by looking at other, maybe even risky things you can do at the same time, because then you've only got that cost of change once for those kind of risky changes, for example.
That makes sense.
I think so. And I think it's often enough about picking which combinations of things you can change as well, because you can often choose the one risky thing which you've got to do, you've got no option, but there's a couple of other low-risk things you can do that might make quality of life better, they might make the developer experience better, they may reduce the risk of the future changes you have to make.
Yes. I think the other thing that's really interesting as a CTO is actually human capital as well.
Right.
Because we're prone to talk about developers and believe that, you know, developers are a fungible resource, right? So that you can move them from project to project, but they're not.
Swap them in and out, yeah.
Some you can, but not all of them, right? And actually, probably the more technical debt you've got, the less fungible your teams are, right? Because you've got more and more islands of technology that prevent you.
And deeper specialisms.
Yeah, and deeper specialisms. So that is quite an interesting debate. And that kind of links into something that I've learned over years, is that your technology estate starts to resemble your organization. So when you think about doing organizational change, sometimes your technology can become a real inhibitor to your organizational change.
Right, because of the fact that your organization mimics, or at least your technology typically mimics the structure of your organization.
Yes.
But once it gets to a certain point, the technology is sort of fixed, which means your organization is fixed as well.
Well, your technology and organizational, it becomes siloed. The organization and the technology become siloed, right? Yeah. And then at that point, it then becomes hard, really hard to change your organization, because you have to unpick some of the technology.
Yeah, and that's one of those areas where I've always found that in order to be able to justify those changes, I have to, rather than just saying, oh, technical debt, we need to do technical debt, which, you know, most leaders I've found hate that phrase. They sort of become allergic to it because it's meaningless. So rather than that, I try and translate that into a business risk or a business impact, often with a probability and a cost, you know, should that happen, should the probability occur. And have you ever had to sell technical debt or technical debt reduction to non-technical stakeholders? And would you use that kind of approach for something else?
Yeah, so I think business risk is a really good way of doing that. I've been known to use the car analogy as well, that says, you know, would you never service your car? How many MOTs would your car go through before it failed an MOT if you never serviced it? I can use that analogy sometimes, but it really is about the impact on the business, right? And being able to articulate that, as you said, both in terms of probability and what happens if it does. What happens if this breaks is a brilliant question. Right. And certainly in Direct Line, some of my teams would say, what is the question? You know, when they were preparing stuff, what's the question that Sarah would ask?
They prepared themselves for that justification for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think when it comes to the car analogy, it's always a good one, isn't it? Because the difference between probability and impact is quite graphic. If you say, well, a wheel's fallen off. Okay, what do you mean by that? Is it the hubcap that's fallen off? You know, the little face plate that makes it look good? Or is it the steering wheel that's falling off? Because those are two very different impacts in terms of...
Yes. And the other really interesting analogy is an insurance analogy that says, if your car is a year old and it's got a small dent in it, then they'll fix it. If your car is very old and it's got a small dent in it, the likelihood of it being fixable gets lower over time.
Yeah, and also the desire to fix it when it's older and has a dent in it, lower over time as well.
Yeah.
Until you end up the unloved piece of software in the scrap heap, which happens. Mainframes, not mentioning anything. Cool. Yeah, so I think one of the other things I wanted to ask you about as well, because it's such a big passion of yours and somewhere where you've made a big difference in the industry, is championing diversity in technology. As a woman in this industry that is famously fairly male-dominated, you know, what's sort of one unexpected or overlooked way in which CTOs can create a more diverse, more inclusive culture that actually works and sticks?
Yeah. Well, I think so. That's a really good question. Right, there is no one answer. Right.
I suspect it's much, but
I will tell you that just increasing, increasing the role models and the number of women in the organization really helps, right? Because the atmosphere changes, the culture changes, and it becomes much more collaborative, right? The other thing I think really helps is allies, right? You know, we spend a lot of time talking about what women can do, but actually it's also about allies, right? One of the things that I suffered from early in my career was that I would say something in a meeting and I'd just be ignored, right? And if a man said it, everyone would go, oh, yeah, it's a really good idea, right?
So the supporting voices, really.
Supporting voices, but actually someone just to say, you know, Sarah made a really good point there. Sometimes I've been known to prep people before meetings to say, you know, look, not so much now because I think I've got a voice and I'll use it. But where there are people who are really good but actually aren't getting their voice heard is to prep other people and get them to say, this is what I'm going to say. This is how I need you to support me, right? And I think that helps tremendously because then it makes it visible, makes people think about it. Because a lot of times the lack of inclusion is not anyone having a desire to not be inclusive, just not thinking about it.
Right. So you remove that accident by making sure it becomes front and center in people's attention because there's a tripwire for them to sort of...
Yes. Yeah.
That's a really, really good tip.
Yeah.
I was given another good tip by somebody a long time ago and actually comes at a stage earlier than that. You're talking about increasing the number of women in the organization. And I was with a company, they were hiring people at the time. And there was a consultant that had come in from a third-party consultancy. He was doing something completely different. I can't remember what it was. But he took one look at the job spec that one of the team members had put together and said, you're not going to get any women from that. No women will apply to that at all.
Yes.
And we were sort of really shocked by that because we hadn't really thought about it from that perspective. And it stuck with me because of how simple it was. And it was simply a question of removing all the things that said, you have to, and just changing the language to be desired and expected rather than must. He said, there's just a psychological difference. Men will go, yeah, I'm close enough. I'll give it a shot.
Yes.
Where you go, no, I don't fit that 100%. I don't feel confident I'm going to apply for that. Mm. And then the other wording that he got us to change as well was just a little sentence at the end of the description of the job about mentoring, coaching, and support. And he said that was one of those clauses that will just, when you add something like that in, where it shows that there is support for people, the ratio of women applying will go up just with that one thing.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's such a simple change. And yet we did that. Lo and behold, we ended up recruiting 25% women into an area where you'd expect it to be about 5%.
And I think the other thing is flexibility, right? I've noticed this. If you put flexible working in the job description, you get a lot more women applying as well.
And obviously where you can back that up, because some companies can't, but where you can, I think that's such a simple thing to add that will make a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Huge, huge.
And I think that's the key thing about all of those things, aren't they? They're all relatively small, cost very little, but have a surprisingly big impact.
Indeed, indeed. And I think the other thing is role models, right? If you see people in the organization who are female and thriving, that tells you that you can also thrive in that organization.
And I've noticed that. There's one company I'm coaching where the two founders are women. And funnily enough, the head of technology and product there is a woman. Brilliant. Some of the most senior developers there are women. And it's just as soon as you have a person of influence, it has an impact on how many others go, I can work there. I can do that.
And in a large, complex organization, it's also seeing the steps on the ladder, right? Because, you know, 30 years ago, we talked about middle management layers being, you know, blockers. Right. If you see lots of women at the bottom and then lots of women at the top and no one in between, that tells you something about the maturity of the organization. And so it's seeing that people are growing their careers in the organization.
Right. So people all the way up, not just at certain points in the hierarchy.
Yes.
I think that's a subtle but important point.
Really important.
In fact, I'd be a bit blind to that because I've not worked in massive organizations, but that's probably very clear from when you're working inside them.
Yes, Yes, you can see it in some large organizations. Yes, definitely.
And talking about that sort of support and mentoring, I mean, many CTOs step into leadership and they don't have that much in the way of formal training or leadership training. Are there any things that you think, I just wish I had been either taught, shown, or guided on that earlier in your career?
Oh, gosh. That's a really interesting question. I would tell you emotional intelligence is okay. Something that I think everyone should learn. But I also think...
What do you think the impact of that was if you don't have any grounding or awareness of emotional intelligence?
I do remember times when I was dogmatic to the point where I'm surprised that no one sacked me, but because I was convinced I was right. Actually, I think a bit more emotional intelligence could well have helped me at that point in time. I think everyone also needs to understand the business that they're working in. Right? We used to do this at Direct Line. We used to go and sit sometimes in the call centers and listen to some of the calls. It was a brilliant way of really understanding your customers, is to listen to them in some shape or form, right? And again, you know, Amazon has this same concept of, you know, the customer in the room, which we forget at our peril, right? So yeah, I think that's really important.
So being able to make sure that you've not only can hear the customer's real actions, points, perspectives, but that you've got the emotional subtlety, the emotional awareness to be able to understand the reading in the room effectively.
Yes. Yeah. I think the other thing, as I say, is the T shape on the T, right? How businesses work, right? You know, how just things like sometimes technologists forget about money, right? Because money's not quite as important as technology, clearly. But having that broader perspective sometimes is also really helpful.
Yes, I mean, that's the second time you've mentioned T-shaped, isn't it? So by T-shaped, you mean having a broad, wide set of skills, capabilities, knowledge, as well as your specialism that should be sort of the downward part of the T.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I was very lucky. Before I became a CTO, I had some coaching in leadership. So I got some grounding, you know, in what you need to do, how to fire people, how to handle conflict, how to, you know, what your sort of leadership lessons like that. I mean, were there any particular standout leadership lessons that you had that came from somebody who was, you know, perhaps a mentor, perhaps somebody with a lot of experience that helped you sort of avoid some of those potholes in the leadership journey?
Oh, gosh. I think this thing about control is an important one,
right?
Particularly in know what you can control and know what you can't control. I think that's always important. Yeah, it's probably one of the biggest ones for me.
And how did that manifest as an issue, as a challenge, as a trouble that you had to overcome where you were, I don't know.
I just wanted to be involved. It was like going, I need to be involved in this. And before you knew where you were, you were like, I can't do all of this. Right. And it was kind of linked to trusting people who work for you, right? You know, right. Building the teams, and it really comes back to the build your team to be the next generation of leaders, right? Because if they are leading and providing leadership and you trust them, then you don't have to do it yourself, right? So again, it's about trusting others to lead. Right. So therefore, you're not in everything and just giving them a framework within which to work. But at the same time, knowing that you have their back, that you are supporting them, that you are helping them to do the right thing for the organization or the project or whatever they're doing.
So it is really about changing the way in which you have control rather than hands-on personally. I have my leader, my person who I trust and I have delegated properly to, for them to have control of it.
Yeah. And then when you say it like that, I mean, in a large organization, you know, control, you're never responsible for something solely responsible, right? Yeah. And then you go, actually, part of being a leader here is about building that consensus with the people. It's working out who else needs to sign this off and building that consensus in a timely fashion. I do remember one CTO saying to me that by the time he'd gone around all his stakeholders, they'd all change. You know, the first one had kind of changed and moved on. And so he felt sometimes like he was in a perpetual loop of going around to stakeholders to get consensus. And you just go, no. You need to recognize that that is an issue and do something about it, because actually you're never going to be able to do something if that's the case. But it is, in a large, complex organization, it is about understanding your stakeholders, understanding the dynamics of the relationships and building that consensus so that you can move forward.
Yeah, and I think consensus is one of those important things, isn't it? Because it's literally somebody giving you consent, but then people as a whole giving you the collective so that there is enough of an agreement you can move forward. Because then you end up with all, I mean, you must have, because you were at Amazon. One of my favorite things that came out of Amazon leadership is the sort of the disagree and commit approach to things.
Yeah, yes. Which makes for some robust discussions in meetings, right? But I do think it is much better than the disagree and don't commit, right? And culturally, I have worked in organizations where people may not agree with you, but they don't feel that they can speak up and disagree in a meeting, right? You don't get that in Amazon. You do get people going, actually, I don't think this is the right thing to do. But then you have a conversation about it. And when you get to a consensus, you know, when you get to a course of action, you will go, okay, we commit. We follow that. You know, we are aligned behind it. And the interesting thing there is that disagree and commit gives you an explicit, it becomes explicit rather than being implicit. And I think that's also important.
Yes. So it's a disagreement rather than just a dissenter. Who
yes, or even a silent dissenter. I mean, the worst dissenter in the world is the silent dissenter.
Because right? They tend to undermine over time as well.
Yeah.
Whereas at least there with that approach, it's open, it's in the clear, and therefore unambiguous.
Yes. Yeah.
Nice. Sarah, I'm going to try the impossible here, which is to try and distill your immense wisdom and experience down into a few key steps in a playbook. So luckily I've made some notes beforehand. So number one on your playbook for CTOs is to master the art of alignment, which we were just talking at the end there as well. Bringing people together and making sure that you've got enough of an alignment that you can move everything forwards. We talked about the complexity, about how much complexity you can handle, taming it where you can, but then making peace with what you can't tame.
Yes.
We spoke rather generally about technical debt in a way, but I think the perspective I understood from you is that technical debt isn't particularly an engineering issue, it's a leadership issue.
I think it's a leadership issue because we can't solve it on our own. In a technology organization, you cannot solve technical debt on your own. Right? And actually, it is actually around really understanding that technology is an asset, and therefore an asset has to be managed in the same way that any other asset has to be managed.
And any other asset goes through a life cycle, has an amortization process, and eventually it comes to an end of life.
Yes.
So therefore, managing the technical debt from that perspective, rather than looking at it as an engineering problem, is the more, I guess, mature way of looking at it.
Yeah,
I like that as a mental model. It's really good. And then something that we covered in many different ways, but is about scaling yourself as an individual. And great CTOs, therefore, deliberately scale themselves as well as their teams.
Yes, absolutely.
Step four. And I always think of that as a really simple one. I think of it as a pyramid. You're only going to be able to stand atop the pyramid if you grow with the pyramid itself. So it's a visual way of looking at that.
Yeah.
One of my favorite topics is inclusion and diversity. And we talked about the structural changes you need to make rather than just well-wishing or, you know, good intentions.
Yes, I hope. Hope is not a strategy, right?
So one of the mantras of one of my first mentors, he said, it's good that you hope that, but last time I checked, hope is not a management technique.
Yes, absolutely.
And then the other thing, which I think is something to sort of pick up if you listen to most of this over again, you find out that there's a bunch of risks. We spoke about risk in a few different ways. We joked about risk, but a career is built on taking specific risks, selecting the risks that you take. And that, in your mind, I think it is the construction of a career, is deliberate selection of the risks that you take.
Yes, deliberately. And I think the other thing, I think back to, so let me just give you an anecdote. 33 years in IBM, right? And there are many people who would have gone, A, that's a brilliant career, and B, why on earth are you thinking of moving? And one of my mentors, he said to me, well, what's the worst thing that can happen, right? You know, actually, you go, you don't like it, right? And it doesn't matter, right? You know, it's, and I always have this thing that says no regrets, right? Once I've made a decision, I make it and I move forward. So I never, you know, I don't look back and go, oh God, I wish I'd done so. No, that's my mantra, is just, you know, make a decision, once you've made the decision, put it behind you and move on, because you can't keep resisting some of these decisions.
And yeah, I think it was Tom had this quote about, you know, much better to move forward or make the choices in the first place. You don't have to worry about if only or what if.
Yes, absolutely. And there's nothing worse than thinking, if only I had gone forward, right? Will you regret it for the rest of your life if you don't do it, type thing? Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So master the art of alignment, make peace with complexity. Technical debt is a leadership issue. Great CTOs scale themselves. Inclusion and diversity requires structural change, and build your career on the risks that you take.
Wow. Sounds cool, doesn't it?
Pretty good. Awesome playbook, isn't it? If all of us can live by that, we'll all have such long and illustrious careers. It'd be fantastic. I don't know if you do this, but if you ever mentor first-time CTO stepping up into the role, particularly in a large, complex enterprise, you know, where you've got most experience, what would be the first three pieces of advice that you'd give to a CTO going into that position today?
So understand the landscape, and that is, you know, that's culture, that's, you know, organization. Build relationships and find a quick win, right? There is nothing better than a quick win to go. You know, you need to be adding value quickly, right? And as a CTO, you have a long-term focus. You want to build my strategy. I've got a five-year vision, right? You need some quick wins as well, because you need to be saying, I know what I'm talking about, right? I'm like, I have this vision, but I can make things happen quickly as well.
That's a really great tip. And if you look back over your career, are there any decisions or shifts that for you were those pivotal moments that just had an incredible impact on your success?
Oh, wow. There were quite a lot, I think. One was this switch from knowing all the answers to knowing the questions. That was really critical. I'll tell you what another one was, actually, was that I was working part-time for, I think, 17 years, right, of my career. And I realized towards the end that actually everyone had forgotten that I was working part-time.
Wow, but that's some impact you're having then.
But fundamentally, mobile phones mean that can be really flexible. I was never averse to saying, I'll take a call on my day off. It's not a whole day, clearly. But actually, the other thing I think that really made a difference to me was that I used to apologize. I'd be like, I'm really sorry, I can't do this meeting because of that. And quite often, particularly when the children were small, it was a childcare problem. But actually, I got to a point where I went, I'm just going to go, my diary's busy. At that time. And it just changed my perception. So I wasn't apologizing, but also I was like, I'm sure half the people who said that to me in the past were like, my diary's busy. Actually, they probably had, you know, they were going to the dentist or childcare or something like that. I was just freeing myself. I wasn't apologizing for the fact that I had children. I was just incorporating them into my working career. So yeah.
And then owning your space.
And owning my space. Yes, absolutely.
That's fantastic. And you know, finally, if somebody would like to get hold of you, have a chat with you, I mean, what are the sort of things that people would get in touch with you for? And how do they get hold of you?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn.
I can put a link in the show notes.
I've been taking a break. Right. Because, you know, I needed a break. I'm looking to move towards much more of a portfolio career, but actually I'm really passionate about bringing technology, AI, data much more into the boardroom. And whether that's helping, you know, boards to understand more about these things, because they are going to be so much more important to boards and to companies as we move forward. So that's part of what I do. But I'm also following my passion, whether it's in diversity, sustainability, and technology. I'm having a ball of time. So I'm open to people talking to me and, you know, as I say, looking for interesting things to do.
Well, that's one thought we'll do. So we'll put a link in the show notes and then people can reach out to you on LinkedIn. And yeah, we'll hopefully continue to see you having such an awesome impact on the industry for a few years to come.
Well, thank you.
Sarah, it's been wonderful having you. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. And to all of our listeners, keep leading with impact. We'll see you in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.